This week on Your Western Context, a rise in BC gang shootings leads to questions about police methods. Two UCP MLAs leave the party, and the Liberals resurrect a month-old gaffe as a distraction. Also, we discuss just what impact Bill C-10 will have on Canadian internet. This is Western Context, episode 219, recorded Friday, May 14th, 2021. Trust issues. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself have returned, as we do each and every weekend. We're going to talk about a whole boatload of news that has just arrived on our shores, and it's definitely things that are, I guess we could say, high risk, and in some cases a little bit I had a bit of a laugh when I was reading through our pre-show notes here.
Yeah, exactly. There's been a lot of stories that have come out, and I think we've picked stories this week that haven't really got as much discussion in the media, and they are still underlying issues that happen in Canada that need to be talked about. And I think that the media not covering a lot of these issues is actually a great disservice to people that would like to know about them. Instead, always going on about the same stories all the time not only leads to uninteresting news, but also means that things that should get covered don't get covered.
That's right, and that's what our objective is here at Western Context, to effectively provide the other side of the story, what the media is not doing, and in doing so, we hope to remove all the media bias and sensationalism that the media injects into their stories. And when we do that, we hope to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we're going to begin this week with our BC story, and of course, if everybody wants to follow along, you can do that in our full show notes at westerncontext.ca.
All right, so last weekend, Vancouver residents were shocked at yet another incident of gun violence in the city. Not only has there been an increase in gang violence in the first part of 2021, but the shootings and murders have been particularly daring and risky. In what may be the most brazen shooting yet, United Nations gangster Carmen Singh Grewal, who is a 28-year-old man, was shot dead near the International Departure Terminal at the Vancouver International Airport last Sunday. Now, Sergeant Frank Jang with the Integrated Homicide Investigation Team says that the victim is known to police and that the attack is believed to be part of the ongoing gang conflict around the Lower Mainland, which anyone reading the story to begin with would have probably figured that out for themselves. Now, Jang says, quote, "I think we're all tired of the violence that's been taking place on our streets. There comes a time when there's just no further words." It's quotes like, "Please do the right thing, please don't kill one another, and stop the violence." Apparently, they're all falling on deaf ears. "It's time to get down to work, find these people, and put them in jail." Now, the Lower Mainland has been the scene of multiple targeted gang-related shootings in recent weeks. In the last 2 weeks alone, there have been at least 6 shootings, 5 of them fatal. In the last month, that's about 10 shootings. And even as we go to record, we have found out about another shooting that had happened just yesterday, and another one that happened today as a result of that one. Now, because of these, it comes down to gang conflicts between established gangs that have been present in the Lower Mainland. The United Nations gang has been locked in a bloody battle with both the Brothers Keepers gang and the Red Scorpions since at least 2017, and the violence has just escalated since that time. Now, all sides have had high-level members killed this year, with retaliation for those shootings sometimes coming in less than a day. Now, the murders, for anyone who is wondering, well, it's just gang members and criminals getting shot, what's the big deal here? Well, the problem is that these murders have been happening in public, in busy mall parking lots, crowded parks, near schools, and outside of a one happened outside of a popular restaurant on the Vancouver waterfront, and some happen right in downtown. There's drive-bys happening. This is a major issue that is really threatening public safety. Now, questions are being raised about why police agencies around the Lower Mainland are not broadcasting the identities of known gangsters that the public can be aware and take caution. Now, during an ongoing turf war in early 2017, the Surrey RCMP put out names and photos of five people that they said were a risk to public safety. This included Gruwall, the man shot and killed outside YVR. Now, BC Solicitor General Mike Farnworth seemed to imply on Monday that more resources to fight the spate of recent gang shootings could soon be coming. Police agencies and units from around the region met with Farnworth on Thursday, which he described as being a successful meeting, and that the police agencies are doing everything they can to curb the gun violence. Now, Farnworth said, quote, "I think we need to use all the tools that we have available to us to deal with the gang upsurge in violence that we've seen in the Lower Mainland, and the police have a significant number of tools available to do that." Now, gang experts believe that the more that the public is aware of who these people are in the community, the better chance that police have to get the situation under control. Retired Vancouver Constable Doug Spencer, who now runs an organization called Odd Squad, which aims to educate kids in schools and about gangs and gang lifestyle. Spencer says, quote, "The more the public is aware of who is doing what, the more sets of eyes you have out there in your community. I support telling the public what's going on, putting out pictures of the guys involved. It takes a village to make everybody safe." He went on and said, quote, "The key thing they've got to stop treating these gangsters like they're poor, misfit, misunderstood kids. They're stone-cold killers. They should go to jail. If you took away and put in jail all these kids using firearms and getting caught with firearms, all of a sudden there would be complete quiet times." And part of this quote has ended up being our quote of the week, just for how quite simple and blunt it is, that the fact that is that the justice system has to keep these criminals in jail, and that they can't treat them like they're just misunderstood. And this is what's completely missing from national talks on gun reforms, a lack of reform with the justice system for weapons-related incidents. If you increase jail terms for these hardened criminals, they won't be on the streets to commit more crime. Now, an increased police presence in the region had uncovered a sophisticated clandestine fentanyl lab in Port Coquitlam, where enough precursor chemicals were found to make what is called, quote, approximately 13 million potentially fatal doses of fentanyl. Now, no arrests have been made as of yet as the investigation continues. Now, Vancouver is getting a bad reputation as a gangster's paradise, and now it's up to our police, our court system, and our provincial and federal governments to make this a priority before it gets even more out of control.
And this is one of those prime stories that can be completely politicized in the media and by the politicians if they wanted to. You know, there's an angle that if this were a Toronto shooting and this kind of thing was happening in Toronto, the story on this would be that, hey, we need more gun control. But, you know, that narrative is conspicuously missing here out west in the Vancouver area. And at the end of the day, it's an opportunity for everybody within Canada to look at the criminal code and see what exactly constitutes a mandatory minimum. And are we doing enough of these? Are we actually using the legal system to its fullest in order to get these thugs off the street? And what's more, there also, of course, needs to be total accountability on the part of the Vancouver Police Department, who in some cases have used the gang backing as almost a intelligence network to get further in within the gangs at the expense of keeping them on the street when they could have brought them in. And of course, here at Western Context, we're not experts on policing, but from the very surface level of that, that does raise some questions. And this is really a story that comes down to following the law, ensuring that a strong law exists, and once you catch these people and ensure that they are put through the justice system, we need to ensure that they indeed do the time for this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these people are committing these crimes in broad daylight. There's any number of innocent bystanders that can get caught in the crossfire, and an escalating in shootings is no good for the city whatsoever. It leads to a bad reputation. It hurts the tourism industry. Innocent people could get injured or even killed, and it's just not a good idea all around. And as we've seen in the past with the Vancouver Police Department, a lot of times they've been making inroads in with these gangs to try and turn them against one another or to try and gain information. And even in the past, plainclothes police officers have been found to have been posing for pictures with different gang members, including the Hell's Angels. And a quote that's out there sometimes is that the police force is sometimes just a gang that has law on its side. And we don't really think that completely, but it's fairly commonplace that former gang members will tell that it's very hard to tell which ones are the cops in their midst and which ones aren't, because they use the same methods. And it's interesting to know exactly what these methods are, of course, but as you said, we're not experts in policing. So I think it's just clear that there needs to be more accountability with this, and not only with the police, but also with the court system, who quite often either are very lenient sentences for these people that get caught committing murders or even caught with illegal weapons on them. But instead, the federal government just seems to want to go after gun control as the simplest and lowest common denominator on the issue. And I think that's something that our federal government and even our provincial governments aren't doing quite correctly.
Yeah, because that's a quick and easy shot to take, and it makes it look like you're doing something. And at the end of the day, it scores things with the base, which, of course, politicians of all stripes love doing, despite what you say. And that's typically the way the ball bounces. But at the end of the day, it's a very outward and easy slogan. You do the crime, you do the time. And I think when it comes down to murder, it doesn't get any more clear cut than that. Even if it is gang members killing each other, it's definitely something that needs to be dealt with and moved through the system, because innocent people can get hurt too in that. So we'll definitely be keeping our eye on this, as we have been keeping our eye on many number of stories in the Lower Mainland that just don't seem to get the light of day, whether it be the casino scandal, the nursing home scandal, or the housing market. But there's so many of those out there, and that's what we do here at Western Context. We talk about those stories that aren't getting talked about in the media and provide that angle that you might not have heard anywhere else, without doing the whole bias and sensationalism bit that everybody else in the media does on all sides and in the mainstream media. And to help us out with that, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/westerncontext. We offer three tiers of support starting at $2 a month. That's as little as the price of a cup of coffee. You'll help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production show notes throughout the entire week. Now, of course, you might be wondering, what are we doing with this? Well, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month. This article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month, where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs might be headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. So with that being said, we're going to move on into Alberta right now, and this is an Alberta story that has been bouncing around, and many people have been wondering when this would finally come to a head. And of course, we are talking about the instability in the United Conservative Party that has been the primary story in the media this entire week, when in reality, there are better things for everybody to be focusing on. On Thursday this week, the UCP caucus ejected MLAs Todd Lowen and Drew Barnes. Todd Lowen is the MLA for Central Peace Notley, and he posted a statement on his Facebook page in the early hours of Thursday morning, calling for the premier to resign and for he himself that he was resigning as caucus chair. And Loewen's issue is that he feels that the restrictions in place really don't fit in line with what the base wants in rural Alberta, as he puts it. He also feels that there are many other decisions made, controversial decisions made, that have damaged the party and threatened unity, in his view, from the coal mining on the eastern slopes of the Rockies all the way to the contract with doctors, and even mentioned the teachers' curriculum that we talked about a few weeks back on the podcast. And keep note as we move through this that there's going to be a parallel in talking points between those in the Todd Loewen and what he views as the base who are upset with what the media is actually talking about. And that's why listeners who are here right now listening to Western Context, you'll see that there is a bit of an interesting overlap there. But we're going to try and cut through this and see what's being said. Drew Barnes, the MLA for Cypress Medicine Hat, has also been one of the most outspoken critics of the government, and these two men were ejected from the party caucus. They were also both early members of the Wild Rose Party, going on to win an election in 2012 for Drew Barnes and for 2015 for Todd Loewen. And there was a time after Danielle Smith jumped ship that many thought Drew Barnes might become the leader of the Wild Rose, but instead that turned out to be Brian Jean. Now, this has led many to paint the UCP with the same brush that the old progressive conservatives were painted with in terms of being arrogant and out of touch. And these exact words were used against former Premier Jim Prentice, and they were actually used this week by Todd Loewen as well. Now, many questions have been raised in this time of instability, including whether or not the Premier has the confidence of caucus to continue. Most of those calls have come from the mainstream media. And alongside this, there have also been criticisms of the UCP for them shutting down the legislature from both the media and the NDP. Now, the ouster of these two MLAs was done by secret vote, and by convention, caucus meetings are supposed to be confidential. Now, in terms of why the MLAs were kicked out now rather than earlier, the Premier said on Friday that it's not a decision about just disagreeing with government policy, because we have a lot of members who have done that, but I think they've done it in a way that tries to maintain the unity of our team. And that was really the basis of yesterday's decision. And that's precisely what this is about here, is that when you look at what Drew Barnes and Todd Loewen did and how that was being portrayed and what that was setting up in terms of the general showdown amongst the caucus members, it was threatening the unity of the party. Now, you have to remember that this is exactly in the name, and everybody who becomes a United Conservative Party member has to agree to uphold party unity, amongst other things that are part of the party constitution. And this is important because thousands of grassroots members in 2017, recruited by both the Progressive Conservatives and Wild Rose, voted to bring these two parties together. That was less than 4 years ago. And in the span of 4 years, a political party was created from two, a platform was built, and an election was won, and the UCP has gone on to do a great number of things that they said they were going to do in that platform book. Now, politics in Alberta in the new millennium has been inherently unstable, to the point that no premier has won re-election since Ralph Klein in 2004, after either inheriting a mandate and running for re-election, or just inheriting a mandate at all. Both Stelmach and Alison Redford inherited mandates, went to the polls and won. They were then later both forced to resign before it was time to carry on their next election. Jim Prentice didn't even get that far and win his first mandate after being handed it over after the resignation of Alison Redford. And of course, we all know the story about Rachel Notley and the NDP. They were a one-term government. Put simply, the voter base in Alberta over the last 20 years has been volatile, and as a result, political parties that want to find success in the province must maintain internal unity. And that's something that we even saw under the former NDP government, that in the span of 4 years, they only had a few spikes of internal caucus strife, and those were put down quickly. And it shows that if you don't maintain that, political parties in Alberta in general like to toss their leader. Now, what this means for everyday Albertans is that in an era where the loudest voices get amplified over social media and alternative media platforms, we need to look up and question if the narratives of our preferred sources are actually feeding us the truth. Now, looking at this, the non-biased state of play in Alberta is currently as follows. Going into the pandemic, Albertans were deeply upset and divided over the policies put forward by the Trudeau government. Second, Albertans have a libertarian streak that can be traced back to 1800s era migration from what is now the northern United States. Number three, non-mainstream outlets have to resort to sensationalism and division to build a base of their own. This is amplified over social media, giving those who are upset with the restrictions and policies of what is probably, depending on how you look at it, the most conservative government in Canada, a space for an outlet. Fourth, there's an argument to be made for completely relaxing or removing all COVID restrictions, and anyone who immediately shuts this down or doesn't hear the argument out further entrenches those who are upset with the government of the day. And fifth, had we had our vaccine at the timetable of the United States, we wouldn't be having this conversation whatsoever. So boiling this down, most of the strife that people see in Alberta, or the perceived strife as it is, can be pointed out to external factors, boiling down to social media and the way alternate media has to agitate. And of course, the federal government itself, in terms of the vaccine rollout and the policies that they put forward. We've said this time and time again here on the show, the pandemic will end, and it will end soon. And based on what we've outlined here as the state of play, we have to ask, when the pandemic is over, do the Albertans who supported the UCP last time, around 55% of the voting population, really want a divided United Conservative Party that's carried out on a good chunk of the things that they said they were going to do? Any media outlet or group that seeks to play the base of the UCP against the UCP for their own gains is no better than what the mainstream media and the NDP do. And this is precisely what the NDP wants and what they need to win in 2023. People can be upset at the government, but it doesn't need to result in creating a new political party. The Conservative parties in Canada, the UCP and the Federal Conservative Party of Canada, have one of the most open membership policies that there is. Anyone can become a member. Anybody can vote in those leadership reviews that are going to be coming up next year. Anybody can become a candidate. And further to that, we don't have obscure systems in the United Kingdom, or rather, like in the United Kingdom, where in their Conservative Party, only a set list of people were eligible to become Conservative Party leader after the departure of Theresa May. So in general, political discourse in Canada is a lot more open, and there's plenty of outlets for people who are upset with the UCP, even NDP supporters who are upset with their leaders. There's plenty of opportunities in our systems to make that right without resorting to voting for third parties and effectively splitting votes and undoing the work that so many have done over the last 4 years. The time of reckoning against Justin Trudeau will come for those who are upset, and the province is slated to have an equalization referendum in the fall, and the government is potentially looking at doing things going forward that will implement what the Fair Deal panel recommended last year for, in effect, making a fairer deal for Alberta within Canada. Now, despite what UCP supporters might feel, the entirety of the party has not turned against the party leadership. And in the Calgary Sun Letters section, one of the more interesting parts of the paper, two writers expressed support for the UCP, showing that there's still a section of the population that supports the government, and they aren't being very vocal. Finally, all the hyperbolic media coverage focused around internal party matters this week has distracted from many core news stories this week that we could have talked about that are very consequential for Alberta, such as the Alberta Justice Minister calling out the NDP in media, Alberta unveiling a new higher education reform strategy, and the CBC pointing the finger at right-leaning people, populists, and the uneducated as being vaccine skeptics. I would have much rather talked about any of these stories this week here on the podcast in their own right because they're all very important. But the way that everything has been framed this week, it's shaping up that many in the media are setting this up to see a repeat of what happened with Alison Redford and Ed Stelmach that led us to the path of where we're at with the UCP presently. We're not there yet, but the media seems to think we're heading in that direction.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting how the disparate views of certain members of the UCP have led to this point. And it's interesting how it's right there in the name. It's a United Conservative Party. And this is a Conservative Party that expresses views from all sorts of the center-right and the right-leaning side of the political spectrum. All sorts of conservative views, from social conservatives to fiscal conservatives, rural population, urban population. Anybody can have any sort of different views, and they're welcome in that party. But it stands to reason that you have to rally around the leader of the party in times of strife and difficulty, and this is what most of the party has been doing, but certainly a small few of them have not wanted to do that, and they've wanted to go in a complete different direction altogether. And to that I say, well, if you're wanting to weaken the party that's in power, just look on the other side of the aisle in the legislature and look at who's over there and find out whether you'd like to agree more with the NDP, or if you feel like you agree more with United Conservatives. And I think that for political party members and for the UCP MLAs themselves, I think this is an interesting question to ask, because if the UCP falls, what kind of government do they think they're going to get? It's not going to be the Liberals. It's not going to be the Alberta Party. It's not going to be some offshoot of the Conservatives. It will be who is established and who is the opposition. And that's something that I think a lot of Albertans don't want to see. Certainly a fair number of Albertans would like to see that, but certainly not anywhere near majority. But a lot of the media would like to see the NDP return to power, and they're probably going to be pushing those stories to make it seem like they're imminently in return to power. But I think that a lot of Albertans wouldn't like to see the return to the recession days of the oil downturn, partially caused by the Alberta NDP with their policies and their business decisions. And, this crisis will be over sooner rather than later. I mean, it'll just take a bit of time to get through the rest of the pandemic at this point, but it'll be over at some point, and all of these issues that are being talked about will go away at some point. So for people to be making their line in the sand on this issue, it's a little bit confusing.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, that's why I said that this is being framed as very much of an Ed Stelmach or an Alison Redford type situation. And, you know, very well, if this does continue on and there's more questions about the way the premier has handled things from within the party itself, from within riding associations, we could very well be on the path to Ed Stelmach. We could very well be on that path. But to, you know, frame it in the sense that this is the end, the immediate end of the party leader, this evokes exactly what happened when Alison Redford disappeared. And recall, of course, that she had her cronies, and so many things that she did were eventually referred to the RCMP for investigation, things that were borderline criminal, and so much graft from her and her family associated within the premier's office that it really did put that negative taste in the progressive conservatives. And they just weren't able to shake that off after she departed. So we aren't at that stage yet, but it's really important to just underscore how much of the narrative on this is being shaped by alternate media. And it's being shaped by alternate media because the people who supported the UCP in the last election don't have a mainstream right-leaning view. It doesn't exist in the province. It doesn't exist in Canada. Had they had that view to have some of their ideas at least presented in a form that slants toward the way that they view things, we might be having an entirely different discussion on this. But because the media landscape in this country is so fragmented and effectively owned by one or two corporations that gets handouts from the federal government, we're in a situation here where people have no choice but to go to that alternate media. And that alternate media and the way it's set up, has to inflame tensions in order to get views and likes. And that's just the way the ball bounces. And we talked about this with a few other stories recently as well.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty much what it is that the media will talk about Alberta in a particular way, and it will talk about Alberta across Canada in a very specific way. And a lot of reporters are, you know, almost, you know, sitting in their chairs cackling with glee and rubbing their hands together because they think that there is going to be some sort of controversy out of this that they can report on. And that's just something that the UCP cannot let happen, because if they do, they're going to be going down a path that they don't want to. And I think that's really nothing to be further said about that one.
Yeah, and, you know, media in general, lots of people in Alberta who are anchoring our newscasts aren't even from the province in some cases. They're from different provinces as well, so that doesn't help matters. And it's fairly easy to tell who these people are, and it just creates more controversy. And in general, controversy bubbles up, and then it bubbles down. And we weren't anticipating that we would need to talk about this next story on the show, but lo and behold, here we are.
Yeah, because this story is actually about something that happened a month ago, and you're probably thinking at this point, well, you know, you guys at Western Context are always current and up to date with the topics, and we always do something that's topical. Well, this story happened a month ago, and we didn't talk about it at the time because, honestly, it wasn't really that important of a story for the media to be talking about, but the federal Liberals have brought it up again as another national news item, and, well, now we're talking about it. So last month on April 15th, Quebec Liberal MP Will Lamos, he was out for a jog around in the Ottawa area near Parliament, and he was getting some exercise, came back to his work office, and was changing out of his jogging clothes and was going to put on his work suit. As he was at that point, he was late for a committee meeting. Instead of representing his constituents, he was out getting some exercise. So he came back to his office. He was changing out of his clothes and, oops, he discovered that his webcam was on because the committee meeting had already started. His computer was on, his webcam was on, and suddenly everybody in Parliament could see him without any of his clothes on. And that was a bit of a shock to Parliament because, well, it's not every day that a MP will actually appear nude on camera. And this understandably broke parliamentary procedure. Now, after Amos had made the news and news around the world mocked on late-night comedy shows, it was quickly forgotten. But the Liberals are now reviving the story to try and force the truth from the Bloc MP who first took a picture of the embarrassing gaffe. Now, Liberal MPs are seeking to have a Bloc Québécois MP, Sébastien Lemire, appear at the House of Commons committee to explain why he took a photo of Amos's accidental nudity and who he shared the photo with. Now, the testimony, if it happens, will take place behind closed doors because of legal and parliamentary procedure considerations. Now, Lemire had admitted to taking the photo back on April 21st, and he apologized to Amos, but said that he didn't know how it was leaked to the media and how it became public. Now, at Thursday's meeting of the House of Commons Board of Internal Economy, Liberal Government Whip Mark Holland said that a public apology isn't good enough. He said, quote, "If this was any other workplace, I can guarantee you an apology and walking away as if nothing happened wouldn't be the end of the matter. Imagine if this was a female colleague. What would our discussion be?" Now, MPs from all of the other parties on the committee all objected to Holland bringing it up during the public portion of the meeting, despite the fact that it was already scheduled to be discussed later in camera. Now, in camera is a term used by Parliament to mean without public access. Now, the opposition MPs also said that the committee traditionally works by consensus, and that Holland's move to have a public vote to force Lemire's appearance breaks that custom. Now, the Liberals are demanding answers on this and attempting to take the moral high ground on the issue, but they've also been consistently repeatedly voting to kill any debate on the sexual harassment scandal in the military. Now, Holland, who is trying to play the reverse Uno card and garner sympathy based on gender, is also odd, given how many Liberal MPs have had to leave caucus in the last 6 years due to sexual harassment claims. It almost seems that by trying to bring up an issue from a month ago, the Liberals are trying to distract from something else entirely, and this is quite honestly quite well within the Liberal government playbook to do this, is to distract from another issue by talking about something else that's not really as important. So it almost seems that by maybe by reminding everybody of last month's momentarily viral photo, which by this point had been forgotten until the Liberals brought it up again, they're actually trying to distract from their inaction on the Vance scandal. At this point, nobody cares about a naked Liberal MP caught on camera not doing the work that he was elected to do. What Canadians do care about is about our jobs, our lack of housing prospects, rapid inflation, and any other numerous problems brought on, about, or exacerbated by the pandemic. Now, if anything, this is just another cautionary tale to anybody who is operating a webcam. If it's pointed at you and it's plugged in, just assume it's on and you'll be fine. Now, this is a lesson that many Liberals have had to learn in the Zoom era of Parliament. Back in November, Ontario Liberal MP Mariam Monsef was caught on camera discussing her salary, not realizing her microphone was on. She was heard saying, quote, "The question they're going to ask me, how much do I make now? Like $250K. She could be heard saying this before the feed cuts back to the House. So it's clear that this story of Will Amos was brought back as a distraction from other issues. The Liberals would be wise to just move on to more important matters. It's good that the media has been shaking their collective heads on this issue as well."
Yeah, and you know, the media could talk about this if they wanted to, and it definitely has the shock value associated with it that if they wanted to, they could make this a story for a few days here and there. But at the same time, this is something that, in general, is a procedural blip. And, you know, you ask the question to any Canadian out there, do you really care about something like this that happened in the House of Commons, a 30-second episode that is being amplified up there so much so that the Liberals are willing to investigate this, but they're not willing to investigate other things and not willing to bend on Bill C-10, which is coming up next. And, you know, which just so happens as of recording this, that it was revealed that Major General Danny Fortin, who is in charge of the vaccine rollout, will also be taking a step back from the military amid an investigation. And based on how these military investigations are going, I think we can take a guess at what direction this is in. So the very fact that this is becoming an issue is distracting from so many other things that the government needs to be focusing on in this time during the pandemic. And if they're not focusing on those things that really matter, you have to ask, what are they using the taxpayer money for? And are they abusing the goodwill that people gave them when they sent them to Ottawa?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the question that many in the media that actually did cover this particular story hadn't been asking. What are they distracting from? What are they not covering that they could cover instead of this? And why exactly would they try to bring it up again? And those are three questions that I think that everybody still has regarding this story, if they're actually reading it at all. And I think that that's something that the media could have been asking about more so than actually going through it and, you know, trying to figure out why exactly this is a story again, It's been very difficult, of course, to try and connect those dots, but that's what we're always here for at Western Context, to try and do that for you.
Yeah, and, you know, that's something that needs to be done, the media doesn't do, and, you know, outlets on the left and the right, they claim to do that, but once again, as we talked about in the Alberta story, they inflame tensions for their own benefit, which is something that we clearly stay away from here at Western Context. And, you know, this pivots nicely into our firing line, because in terms of what the government is focusing on and what they're not focusing on, Bill C-10 is back in the news, and this is an on-again and off-again roller coaster of progress that we've seen on this bill over the last 2 weeks since we first talked about it here at Western Context. And things look to be going in the right direction on Sunday night, as Stephen Gilbo announced that, in his view, social media users will never be regulated by the bill, and that the government was effectively going to tap the brakes on the bill on Monday. Well, it underwent a chartered review to see if any freedom expression rights would be violated. Now, fast forward to Thursday, Justice Minister David Lametti announced that the bill had passed charter review and that no rights would be infringed. We'll talk about what his statement meant in just a moment, but the simple form is that the Department of Justice feels that there's adequate limits on what the CRTC can and can't do, so it's not a problem. Now, for his part, the Justice Minister delivered the verdict that the government wanted, but Stephen Gilbo seems as incompetent as ever on the file. Now, speaking with CTV News this past Sunday, Gilbo said that individual users wouldn't be targets, but the CRTC could have powers related to discoverability of online content. Now, those of particular interest to this bill would be those people who have millions of viewers and, as he said, generate a lot of money on social media and act like broadcasters. But when pushed for additional information on the thresholds, he had no answer on that. And the answer that Gilbo and his cabinet colleagues were hoping that would take off was that a new amendment was proposed this week that would outline what powers the CRTC may have with this bill. And for the amendment, that's what made this bill pass charter review. Effectively, the CRTC would have the power to prioritize or deprioritize content in the name of discoverability based on how Canadian it is. And in this interview and through the amendment, Stephen Gilbo managed to confirm what everyone opposed to C-10 had been saying. He just didn't say it outright. But what he confirmed in this interview that you can read in our supplementals at westerncontext.ca was that social media users with large followings will be regulated, but not by the government, but by the CRTC. Now, in addition to being able to request changes to discoverability and algorithms, the CRTC will be able to ask platforms how much revenue they make, and they'll be able to ask for a portion of that revenue to be funneled into Canadian cultural productions. And to further highlight what Stephen Gilbo is missing on this, he tweeted an excerpt of a blog post by a fellow named Gord Dmitriev, who is an independent music publisher and record label owner, who called the C-10 backlash, in his words, predictable and dangerous, saying that observers have sounded alarm bells about the role of social media in manipulating public opinion at scale by spreading fake news and toxic narratives. He went on to conclude, adding, "We are now witnessing public opinion being manipulated at scale through a deliberate campaign of misinformation by commercial interests that would prefer to avoid the same regulatory oversight applied to broadcast media." Now, despite what this independent author says, who could very well be subject to these regulations, there are no conspiracy theories floating about, and Gilbo's decision to highlight the passage in a tweet also further raises questions about what the true motives of C-10 are and what Stephen Gilbo is missing. Returning to Justice Minister David Lametti's statement, he said that the bill doesn't violate the charter, and this was announced on Thursday, so the bill will likely go ahead at this point. His review found that the amendments that were put forward this week with the bill, in that it doesn't seek to regulate users directly or specify what proportion of content should be Canadian, is what allows the bill to effectively not infringe on charter rights. The Justice Department also said that an additional consideration was that the government was moving to limit the CRT's power over social media platforms to provide information, pay into the Canadian content system, and the bill's provision to allow for increased discovery of Canadian creators was a factor in the bill passing charter review. Now, these statements, according to Michael Geist, who is the widely accepted expert on internet law in Canada, and he's also the Canadian research chair in internet and e-commerce law at the University of Ottawa, said that this shows that the Justice Department, what they did, wasn't exactly a charter analysis, but more of a trust us declaration. And he feels that the declaration that the Department of Justice put forward could be could have holes punched in it by any court that evaluates it. Now, if this bill passes, which is looking likely, the issue will be referred to the courts, eventually adding more questions about what the goal of C10 actually was. Aaron O'Toole and the Conservatives said this week that if they form government, they will repeal C10 and replace the bill with another that adequately funds Canadian content creators. Now, summing all this up, it looks like C10 is ready to become law, and the Canadian content creators won't be regulated by the government, but the CRTC will be able to lean on content providers like YouTube and others to tweak the algorithm to promote Canadian discoverability. But at the same time, we still need to remember that there's no oversight for what the CRTC sees as healthy Canadian content. So what that means is your favorite podcasts like Western Context, because they are critical of the CRTC and the government at times, could effectively be saying that we're not Canadian enough, and they could have the levers pushed on us to say that this is the kind of content that should be toned down a bit. And it's because of this kind of change that the government is relying on the CRTC to do its bidding, and that they say it's going to be done at the algorithm level with the content providers. This is exactly now why the government says that this bill is fine as is.
Yeah, and the government sees no problem with stepping on the rights and freedoms of anybody who goes onto the internet in Canada and wants to discover new artists or new music or new content creators or new videos. They see no problem with tweaking the algorithm to force different people onto other internet users, as long as they're Canadian, or the right kind of Canadian, as has been discussed. They see no problem with that whatsoever. And that's something that is very dangerous, because it's stepping on not only freedom of speech, it's also stepping on the fundamental right of the internet to be free and open, and to be able to do whatever you like, as long as it's not against the law, of course. And I think that that's something that is missing from the discourse in the media on this, is that it's not just a stepping on Canadians' rights and freedoms, it's stepping on the internet's rights and freedoms, and all in the guise of trying to promote Canadian culture. We all know what it really is. It's another way to try and tax businesses as well, and to try and gain even more money from anywhere they can find, because they have a spending problem that has increased the budget many times what it should be. Canada's in debt far more than it should be because of the last 6 years of spending. And now they're trying to make up some of that by changing the laws to not only hurt Canadians, but to also try and get some money back for the government. And there's so many different reasons why the Liberal government wants Bill C-10 to put in, but the media is really only talking about a very small number of them. And the fact that it could impact so many different people, so many YouTube content creators, Instagram influencers, and even podcasts like us here at Western Context, the fact that it can impact any number of those people, and if they get discovered, and their livelihoods. This is something that really should have had much more discussion in the House of Commons, and should have had a lot more debate on, and certainly shouldn't have been able to pass through a minority parliament. And I think that this is something that is an absolute travesty. And looking back, we'll have to see how exactly this bill does impact our internet.
Yeah, and you know, there's another factor with this too, and it comes down to vote buying, because there is a certain segment of the population, probably in Quebec and, you know, maybe downtown Toronto and the surrounding areas, that with a certain amount of hand waving, they're willing to accept that the institutions of government, which are inherently Eastern based, can do no wrong. And this is one, of course, the CRTC. These are the same kind of people who enjoy nightly CBC programming and the like. And as a result of this, they see more Canadian content. This is, in effect, promoting a different form of Canadian nationalism, but relying on the CRTC to do this. And it's through that lens of a different form of Canadian nationalism that, with a certain amount of hand-waving, you can get segments of the population that are absolutely fine with this. And that's precisely why the piece from Gord Dmitriev is such a shocker, is that, you know, with that, the kind of hand-waving that was going on there, you can say, yeah, it's fine. And any opposition is clearly consorted from big tech or maybe some other form of conspiracy group, but it's this kind of hand-waving that allows this thing to go forward. And it really just underscores what the priorities of this government are.
Yeah, exactly. And the government trying to call opponents of Bill C-10 conspiracy theorists just goes to show how they're not wanting to bring everybody together on this issue. They're trying to create an us versus them narrative and demonize anyone who might actually have questions or concerns about how Bill C-10 will impact them personally, especially if they have an online following or if they have a career that has anything to do with the internet. And I think that's something that is missing from a lot of the media coverage, is that the Liberals have really doubled down in calling people that are not even just against Bill C-10, but have questions about it, to call them conspiracy theorists, or that they're buying into misinformation campaigns. It's all the wording is right there in the bill as to what it will actually say, and whether the Liberal MPs that have created the bill have actually read it themselves is another question altogether, considering how much trouble Stephen Guilbeault had in answering simple questions about what was actually located in the bill, and how much discussion there was in the last couple of weeks about certain phrasing in certain sections of the bill that they were debating to get rid of and ultimately decided not to. And, well, this is going to be a major impact on Canadian internet, and not really that much is being made of it, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it really questions what Stephen Guilbeault is missing on this and why he couldn't answer those questions. But at the end of the day, it also boils down into trust, and whether or not you trust what the institutions like the CRTC are going to do. And it's clear that the government does. And like I mentioned, there's a segment of the population that will. And I think that's a good time to move on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week is trust, and that is defined as the firm belief in the reliability, truth, ability, or strength of someone or something. And clearly there is a segment of the population that has trust that the Liberal Party is doing the right thing on this issue, and there's also a certain segment of the population that has no trust that the Liberal government is doing the right thing on anything in particular, but specifically on Bill C-10. And trust is a very apt word, as it can also be described in our BC story about the gang shootings, that the public has to have trust that the public and the courts and the governments are doing the right thing for us. But instead, the trust is being eroded by the mass number of shootings that have been happening over the last month or so. Now, trust can also apply to the Alberta story in the sense that Alberta MLAs need to trust that their government and the party that they've been a part of for so long will do the right thing, and that that they can work together and still have that trust that they can get things done. And of course, the trust can also apply to the Will Emo story, in the sense that there's a huge Liberal complaint that politics is being eroded because there's no trust between MPs anymore. Well, we also have to trust that our MPs are doing the best job that they can, and that they're doing the work that they were sent to Ottawa to complete. And, well, the trust between the constituents and their MPs is probably not very high at the moment.
Yeah, and you know that's something that only further inflames those divisions, and that's just more things that alternate media can capitalize on with that, and it doesn't do any good for the entire population, and that's why we're here. And you know, there's hope that someday the media will change and reform, but we're not there yet. And until then, Western Context will be having these discussions each and every week, and you can follow those along in our show notes at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Casts, and more at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And, of course, you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook, where we share some of the stories that we're looking at. And we also share these podcasts there, too, both Twitter and Facebook, at Western Context. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always be sure to look through all the stories of the week that get talked about and some that don't get talked about in going over the news and media, no matter where we may find them, in radio, TV, print, or online. We will find them, and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. With that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.